Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of the Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change the norm in this sector rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. This month's episode of Making Change is a special one, our one-year anniversary. To celebrate, three of my guests from this past year have come back to talk about, well, whatever comes up as it relates to improving our communities. With three powerhouse guests tackling big issues together, this episode will be longer than normal, approximately an hour in length. If you're listening via the Chronicle's website and you'd like to download this episode from iTunes instead, you can do so at this link, creatingthefuture.org/makingchange, all lowercase. I'll repeat that, creatingthefuture.org/makingchange, all lowercase, if you'd like to download this episode from iTunes. First on the panel, Kathleen Enright is the CEO of GEO, Grantmakers for Effective Organizations. Understanding that foundations are successful only to the extent that their grantees achieve meaningful results, GEO promotes strategies and practices that contribute to that success. Next up, Margaret Martin, founder of Harmony Project, a Los Angeles-based organization that teaches orchestral music to children in some of the toughest neighborhoods in LA as a tool for developing not only a creative outlet, but nurturing the creative leadership potential in those children as well. And then we come full circle with Robert Egger. Robert was my first guest on Making Change, and so it only makes sense that he round out the team for our anniversary celebration. Robert is known for his work as founder of the DC Central Kitchen. His book, Begging for Change, won the Alliance for Nonprofit Management's Terry McAdam Book Award in 2005. And Robert's latest effort, the V3 campaign, is all about inspiring the community benefit sector to grab hold of its power to create change. With well over 100 years of combined social change experience among us, it is my pleasure to be part of this anniversary conversation here on Making Change. My guests today on Making Change for this anniversary edition are Kathleen Enright, Margaret Martin, and Robert Egger. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to be with you.
One of the things that I'd like to start by doing is just sort of share a couple of my observations over this past year of doing this program. It has been interesting. As a matter of fact, Kathleen, you and I were having a conversation before our last chat on the show where you sort of offhand said, I wonder how long it will take before folks start to repeat themselves. It's been fun watching that in so far 12 editions of this program, no one has repeated themselves. And I'm looking forward to seeing where all of the other perturbations go with the conversations that we get to have about what it is that creates the kind of change that we are all working towards. Some of the things that I have observed, some of the patterns, there's been a lot of conversation about our working together, our blurring lines, the weaving of networks, building community by being in community with each other. So that's been one really big theme that has been really, really present. There's also been a lot of talk about building on our strengths, building on the power of each of us as an individual, nurturing and creating and energizing that power of each of us as individuals. There's been conversation about, and evidence of, the stories particularly have been striking, about how when we walk our talk, we're the most successful. And that gets to that whole heart of being the change that we want to see, that what we want to see in others, that we model that first. So my construct of looking at everything, as many of you know, is through the lens of the Pollyanna principles. And it has been so striking to me that those six principles have been so present in every single conversation that I've had. Striking that the need that we have for creating systems that connect us, that blur the lines, that build on strengths, that show us how to walk that talk, and first and foremost, that aim us and hold us accountable for creating the future that we want. So it's been a really exciting year for me to watch how folks just have been walking that talk. People are consistently saying over and over again, here are the things that create change. Let's just get out and do them. So with that little bit of observation, that little bit of overview of aiming at the change that we want to create, I want to start with you, Robert, because you were my very, very first guest. You talked a lot when we spoke a year ago about engaging big conversations and focusing on ideas rather than the day-to-day of what we do. Any stories that you can share that you've observed in the past year that really focus on what happens when we focus on those big conversations?
Well, you know, it's been really interesting. I was just in Missoula, Montana, and not only was I, you know, honored to be in a place I'd never been before, but what excited me was there was a woman there who ran the homeless shelter. And oftentimes homeless shelters aren't usually viewed by the status quo of a community, the business community, as, you know, something that they brag on. You know, most of the time they're trying everything they can do to get the homeless shelter out of the downtown core. But here was a young woman who not only did she kind of deal with that, but she ran for office and got herself elected to represent the city of Missoula and Helena in the state legislature, which at so many different levels I was amazed by, because she got herself elected because she felt there were bigger issues than just her homeless shelter and its survival in the downtown, and more than just homelessness and more than just poverty. So here was a woman who, at a time when I think many people in our field might be terrified of confronting people in the legislature who are sometimes not even skeptical, they're outright hostile to the idea of nonprofits, in a town, quite frankly, was also being rocked by the fact that one of their residents who wrote 3 cups of tea was in the newspaper every day. But here she was, willing to stand up and try and lead her community to this better spot, let's put it that way, but participate at that high level. That's just so impressive, and I see that a lot. People, particularly younger people now, willing to stand up and get themselves elected, you know, again, really to try and take the community up to this higher level.
That's really, really engaging the conversation at that highest level. Margaret, a lot of the conversation that you and I had focused on having people have that sense of control in their own lives so that they can move forward. Thoughts about the stuff that Robert is talking about?
Yesterday we had our 10th anniversary celebration for Harmony Project. It's wonderful to be there 10 years after starting with 36 kids. Now we've got 1,300 kids in 10 youth orchestras. But when you step back, everything that we've done began with giving ourselves permission to take action together toward a greater good. And we create opportunities. I think we build the future by creating opportunities for all of us, and especially for our children. So one of the coolest things that we've been seeing is that now we have dozens of our most advanced students taking part as peer mentors, going through training within our program and being responsible for their younger peers. And increasingly, we're using within the organization, we're developing local capacity to continue the work. But at the same time, we've kind of turned a new chapter, because when people see what you're doing and that it's working, other nonprofit organizations in the community are reaching out and saying, we want what you do. So I think that finding economies amongst our patriot nonprofit organizations is one of the ways that we will ensure our viability and be able to replicate increasingly our programs in other communities.
I'm getting back to thinking about Robert talking initially about when we spoke a year ago about replicating ideas rather than replicating programs. And that's really what it sounds like is going on in your community, Margaret, where other organizations that are doing very different things, what they're replicating is not what you're doing, but is really the idea behind what you're doing.
I'm a public health professional. I'm a doctor of public health. What's exciting to me is being able to take something like music education, look at one of the arts, and acknowledge that creating access to music education on an ongoing basis for inner city kids is fundamental public health work. And that's not something that the arts community as a whole has banded around, but we're working to make that happen, because, Lord, the first number of years that I was doing this work, public health colleagues would say, what does music education have to do with public health? And of course, it has everything to do with public health, because the capacity for young people to trust their own voice and to learn to invest in a supported environment in the process of their own learning and their own creative capacity is what the future of our communities, the future health of our communities depends upon. So it's exciting to be able to take the big idea that arts education is fundamental to community health across disciplines and have the light bulbs go on.
I'm thinking so much, Kathleen, about the conversation that you and I had that talked so much about finding those connections and the role of funders, specifically Grantmakers for Effective Organization, dealing with funders. The role of funders in creating those networks, creating those connections that are so critical to what Margaret's talking about and raising those big
ideas. It absolutely is. I've been doing some thinking and reading recently about what it'll really take to discover our common work and to interweave the three themes that you talked about at the front end of this conversation, Hilde, the community building and the working with and through networks rather than relying on our own individual institutions to achieve the change we want to see. How do we best build on those individual strengths and do all of that with authenticity as leaders by, as you put it, walking the talk and being the change that we want to see in the world? And, you know, I think that there's such a role for a conversation about the fact that how we do this work matters as much or more than what we do. I was reflecting on some conversations about the evidence-based practice that everyone gets so very excited about, and we all wish that we were funding things that we know have the ability to make a difference. And when you think about it, though, there has been evidence for a long time of certain practices that have to do with how we do certain kinds of work, including in healthcare. Margaret, you're a public health professional. I think that the medical profession is almost sick of talking about the importance of empathy in any therapeutic encounter, right? It's relatively well known that physicians who adopt a warm and friendly and reassuring manner get better results than those who keep their relationships really formal and don't offer that kind of reassurance. And I think that there's a real translation into the social sector and a real role for empathy in all of the work that we do. And Margaret made the point that, you know, or I guess Hilde, you made the point about Margaret's work, that part of what they do is believe in these kids and support them with the confidence that they show. And I think that that's a role for many of us in the social sector, is believing in something is part of what makes it so. So if we believe the world is a trustworthy place, if we believe that big change can happen, then that's one step in the right direction of making it so.
I think, Kathleen, what you've just said speaks to the more fundamental question that drives our work, that drives our how and our what, which is our why.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What you've just articulated is why we do what we do. And I think that when we live there and when we frame everything that we do in terms of our fundamental beliefs and our fundamental whys, I think that cuts through the crap. Mm-hmm. And it permits us to find common ground with colleague organizations who are also clear about their why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Robert, what are you finding in all of that? Because such a big part of what you're all about these days is finding those conversations, framing those conversations in the why rather than the what. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I'm sympathetic with the bulk of the sector, I think, that is, you know, focused on the immediacy of today. You know, how do I feed my clients? How do I make payroll? How do I deal with devastating budget cuts? So it's understandable that the majority of the sector is really burdened by the day-to-day of who and what. I think we all agree there's probably a uniformity in our sense that it really is the how and the why. how have you chosen to approach your problem? And I'm a big believer. I like the why, but I like the why almost because it opens the door to tactics. I always love to say I'm interested in talking to people about how we have chosen to do our task, but I want to tell them why we've chosen this, because there's a lot of thought that went into it. There's a lot of strategy and tactics behind our particular why. One of the things I love talking about is kind of meeting people where they're at. And, you know, for the average American, they'd rather think, particularly in the realm of human service nonprofits, that, you know, if you're poor, it's your fault. If you're in jail, you deserve it. If you're hungry, you're just lazy, get a job. And people like become very open to the idea of fear. Then why do people behave this way? Why do Americans hold on to these stereotypes when the nonprofit sector has made so much evidence available that it's anything but that? So I become very, very kind of cognizant that it's very important that we get to the conversation of why. But sometimes we're going to have to travel a good distance to meet people where they're at to begin them on this journey, which is why I, for one, am one of these people who's so excited about new media, because it just shortens the distance between mm-hmm. people. You know, even though I love getting out on the road, it's amazing the power of just dragging on a little flip cam that I can record a video and I can put out. And the next thing you know, you've got 10,000 people who've heard your ideas. I'm in this, I think, like we all are, for the long ride. I'm a lifer. You know, I'm a journeyman. This is what I do. But at the same time, I'm a shortcut guy, not out of laziness, but out of just an affirmation that every day in my particular business, 10,000 people in America turn 60 in a community, in a state, in a country where there isn't a plan for, you know, how we treat our elders now is a shame, let alone what's going to happen when 80 million people start to age out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think we have time to dawdle, which is why I'm always open to really, I'm of the school that you almost can't get too crazy. We can't at all be timid in our approaches. But fundamentally, it's about meeting people where they're at and guiding them over this at times intellectual chasm.
What you're really talking about, it's so interesting that the why is, the big picture why is the context for the what and the how. And the what and the how are so critical to that big picture why. They're not an either or. They're a continuum. You're really talking about not only meeting people where they're at, but extending the hand so that they can reach the potential of what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, but I don't mind a little subterfuge every once in a while, too. I often speak to the power of that story of the Trojan horse. It was a 10-year siege that kept the Greeks outside the gates of Troy. And it really wasn't until they took the wood they'd been using without much effect over 10 years and used it in a different way that not only were they in the gates, but the Trojans opened the gates for them. So I really live almost every day. How can I use our how and why not to elevate the idea of the DC Central Kitchen, even though I'm happy to talk about that, or not even to discuss hunger as much as to elevate that bigger why, to inspire average people who are bombarded by negative message and give them every possible reason to opt out. You know, what I'm trying to do is give them one more reason to opt back in and believe again.
Kathleen, what are you finding in the funder community in terms of that larger conversation, in terms of whether it's in the short term, whether it's in the long term, of leveraging those conversations to really get to what's important?
A real thirst is what I'm finding. Just at a recent GEO board meeting, I just asked a couple board members to reflect on the external world and what they're seeing and how that might relate to GEO's agenda or our work. And without any more leading than that, the board members just had a very interesting conversation about the fact that philanthropy is experiencing a bit of a poverty of empathy, and that there's a worry that we're no longer willing to discuss the moral tradition of this work, and instead we're too much trying to sanitize it, I guess, you know, trying to make a clear divide between the sort of technocratic aspects of philanthropy, like evaluation and performance improvement, and the humanistic ones, or the values, the real why of this work. And so I think there's a moment to re-engage in the conversation about why, so that all else, you know, I'm not minimizing the importance of things like paying attention to performance and effectiveness, but I think that they come out a little bit thin unless they are truly laid on the foundation of values and a real clarity about why this work is important.
Exactly. This is what Kathleen, you and Robert have just been speaking about. The greatest deficit that I see in any community, in any country, anywhere in the world. And that remains visionary leadership. Mm-hmm. Because whether you're using a Trojan horse model or a frontal assault, it won't inspire if it's not inspirational. And we have far too few people willing to assume the position of leadership and to help others who make tentative baby steps in that direction find their footing and succeed. I'm finding this now with other Harmony projects are beginning to launch in other communities, and it's with tentative baby steps, and there's a lot of affirmation, a lot of support, a lot of yes, you can do it, and here's how we can help, and here are some other partners that you can find, and here's how it could work, and so forth. In every field, amongst grant makers, in any endeavor, we can only operate if we have something that we're operating toward, a coherent vision that gets us moving and keeps us moving on an ongoing basis. And that takes leaders blowing the breath of life into those projects on an ongoing basis. And what I'm hearing, Robert, is that's something that you spend a lot of your time doing.
I must admit, one of the things I worry about the sector sometimes, I travel, and I've been lucky in my life. I've met people who were great mentors to me when I was a young man. But I've watched so many people who started out being leaders, they got lost in making their programs bigger still. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it was mandated. For example, in food programs, they had to react to need the community. Mm-hmm. But what you have now is almost too many organizations that when they seek to replace that dynamic leader as they step aside, almost have to hire managers to run the machine that is left in their wake. And so what you've got is a lot of big machines, but not the leaders to either have the courage to say, let us leave the machine behind and go in another direction, or people who have the time, you know, that aren't focused on keeping these oftentimes very large establishments going. But Margaret, you touched one of my favorite subjects, because I must admit, I speak at lots and lots of association gatherings. And this is what's, I think, awkward is, by their very nature, associations can be powerful gathering points for men and women who might not ever get a chance to compare ideas with their peers. But all too often, these associations are led by event planners or at times, and God bless their soul, lawyers who've been trained to be risk adverse.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my word.
So I've watched that, and I don't want to stray too far into my area of interest. But, you know, in 2007, I did everything to talk to anybody I could about what I felt was a once-in-a-lifetime shot in advance of the 2008 elections, where there was no incumbent in the race. And you had upwards of a dozen candidates out there trying to differentiate themselves. Yet it was a lonely march to try and get nonprofits to seize this opportunity and even to try and push candidates to articulate a vision that wasn't segmented out into AIDS or arts or housing or healthcare, but a vision that included the nonprofit sector as a sector. You know, this idea of these millions of people who work daily in their community, these tens of millions of volunteers who come through the nonprofit sector to make their idealism manifest in the community. And same thing in 2010 with the 36 governor's races. I think we've missed some really critical opportunities when we should have really been engaged in the process to at least get candidates to demonstrate that they have a sense of their community beyond the Chamber of Commerce and the people who are the usual deciders of who gets elected in America.
Robert, what you're saying right now makes me feel like we lack a national organizing body as committed nonprofit sector workers. Like you, I'm in this for the duration. This is what I do. And there are a whole lot more people like us, but we don't speak with one voice. And I think that if we did speak with one voice, what we would be articulating would be our whys. And our whys speak about who we are and who we want to be as communities, as people, as communities, and as a nation. And I think that it's a message that transcends political ideologies.
One of the things that I have noticed, and Kathleen, Grantmakers for Effective Organizations is so moving in that direction. It's really what you guys are about. There are national bodies that do talk a lot about the work that the sector does. a lot of that talk winds up being back about the what we do and how we do it rather than the why we do it. It's one of the things I've always liked about GEO is you guys are back at the core about why we do the work that we do. In our experience watching this sector, one of the things that we've observed globally is that there are academic programs everywhere for nonprofit management. How do we do the internal stuff? No one is teaching how do we accomplish the why. One of the things I've recently observed is that many of us in this sector resent the term that we should run like a business. And what we resent is the business part. The thing that suddenly occurred to me is that the focus is all on how we run. And how we run is all about the management, is all about the day-to-day, and not about the what we accomplish. I look to GEO, I look actually to the work of all three of you in the focus on what we accomplish. Kathleen, are you seeing any shift in thinking in the foundation world about focusing on what we accomplish rather than the day-to-day of what we do?
Definitely. There's a focus on results, but I think you're making a slightly different point here, Hilde, and one that's incredibly important, which is, you know, how we think about and talk about and frame up the values that underlie this work. And I just want to mention that just in some recent conversations that I've been having, there are a few really great courses in nonprofit management programs. I just spoke with Dr. Richard Gunderman at Indiana University, who wrote a book called Why We Make a Life by What We Give, that is focused entirely on the why of this work and how we focus on cultivating our generosity and turning the recipients or the beneficiaries of nonprofit services into givers, which is something that I think Robert has done incredibly well at DC Central Kitchen. The folks you work with, Robert, many of them end up being philanthropists themselves, meaning volunteers and carrying the work forward so that others can have a similar experience. And I think that that is very much about the why and the moral underpinnings. Now, there are a couple really thoughtful leaders in philanthropy who are trying to shift this conversation a bit. Gerald LaMarche from Atlantic Philanthropies has been highly vocal about this. He's very thoughtful, as is Peter Karoff from the Philanthropic Initiative. And so I would keep your eyes and ears open for philanthropy taking on this conversation in greater earnest in the months ahead.
Wouldn't it be nice if this were just the normal conversation and we didn't have to name individual names, individual programs?
Well, you know, Hilde, it is tough. You know, I was just thinking about this. It's tough to have this conversation because it bumps up very quickly against both religion and politics. And it's hard to have this, you know, moral and values-based conversation in a secular world. Does that mean we shouldn't try? Absolutely not. But I think I understand some of the hesitancy that has built up over time.
I'm not uncomfortable engaging with faith-based groups around an area of common ground, because indeed you have in those groups people who are more willing to typically engage in the values part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Something else struck me when you were speaking, Hilde, about nonprofit management programs. I always go back to leadership. I always go back to visionary leadership. And there's something that takes place in our sector that's a little bit puzzling. Anytime you have someone who is termed a charismatic leader, it's thought to be a one-off. And it's downplayed, it's sort of denigrated as a value, where instead of looking at charismatic leadership and thinking, how can we build this? How can we develop charismatic leadership capacity amongst our client base, amongst the youth that we serve? I hate to see it say, well, charismatic leadership can't be replicated.
Yeah.
Why?
It's interesting. I frequently talk about the fact that we all hold folks like Martin Luther King and Gandhi as an example and as role models. And I frequently say, not even half joking, that Reverend King is a really horrible role model because none of us think we can be him. that we do hold him out as someone separate that we will never be able to be that. But it clearly, both Margaret and Robert, in the work that you have each done in your individual organizations, you are developing leadership in just regular people.
Right.
Going back to the faith thing, it was interesting. I got about a decade ago when that whole question came up about faith-based groups, and I used to love when people would ask if we were faith-based, because they'd say, yes, we are. We have faith in people. To riff a little bit on the religious thing, I must admit, I think sometimes that the work we do is oftentimes mired in this kind of Judeo-Christian redemption of the giver, not the liberation of the receiver model. And that's what I think many of us intuitively want to do, is reverse that flow, or at least equalize it. Because if it's done well, both sides rise up. That's what's exciting about good philanthropy. Both sides benefit. It's the great quid pro quo of Greece, you know, that idea that both sides benefit. If I can take just 1 second, my beautiful sisters, because being kind of the lone dude here, I must admit, I've always been lucky. I've been surrounded all my life by amazing, powerful women. But it wasn't until my later years that I became really a modest student of gender roles in America. And it almost happened by accident, because I must admit I was so frustrated for so many years as to why nonprofits behave the way they do. Why are they viewed the way they are? And I became very intrigued by what we may call the founding mothers culture of the 1970s, when, at least in my take, thousands, tens of thousands of women were denied access to the workplace because they had been housewives or mothers. And they were viewed as not having skills, and they were kind of forced. College-educated women, but nonetheless were kind of channeled into charity. Back then, though, what we're talking about was a calling. You know, there were no training programs in the 1970s for nonprofit management. This is a new phenomenon. And what's been interesting is most of these nonprofit training programs, and I believe there's almost 400 now, most are centered around a business school. And the business school often has to be an incredibly masculine culture in which scale and size is this boring kind of metric that I believe, frankly, has really retarded the growth of or the evolution of nonprofits in the last 10 years, because they're training people to be managers, not leaders. And well, that's I think what's missing.
First, I'd like to ask Kathleen and Robert, and Hilde, are you products of nonprofit training programs?
I am not, Hilde. I am not.
No, I am. I ran nightclub.
Tell us, Kathleen.
I am just on the cusp of that generation that had that possibility. When I was coming out of college, I knew I wanted to contribute to public good and thought the nonprofit sector was the right place to do it. And there was a program at George Washington that I attended. But I have to say that it was still a developing program, and something that was really wanting, in my view, was the richness of conversation about why this work is important. But I think that is more present in at least the programs that are out of public administration schools. I think it's tougher in the business schools, as you mentioned, Robert.
Nevertheless, how you move people has to be a huge part of what we do. And Robert, what you said really resonated with me about both sides of the equation rise, because I find that the more people engage in our program, the more our sponsors engage in our program, the greater the rewards they reap and the more enthusiastic they become. And it's really transformational for our sponsors and for our community partners as much as it is for the at-risk kids that we engage. When I completed my degree in public health, it was in a department called community health science. And most of the people who completed that kind of a program went and got a job. But I took the concept community health science really seriously, and I needed to do something that clearly would make the community a healthier place. So it sort of forced me to think differently. But going back to something that you said, Robert, I want to add a piece of information about a little piece of gender-based information that came out of UCLA in the year 2000. You've all probably come across the concept of fight or flight as the stress response, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, it turns out that fight or flight is a testosterone-based stress response, and it's not the stress response for most women. female physiologist at UCLA engaged in a conversation in the late part of the 20th century where they were laughing about the difference in the way they responded when their experiments went awry. The male colleagues would hole up in their offices while the women would clean the lab and talk. And so they thought, gosh, could there be a physiology connected with this? And being physiologists and being women physiologists, they did research that had never been done. And lo and behold, they discovered that the estrogen-based stress response is not fight or flight. It's tend and befriend. It's nurture and connect. So I think that while women might have been shunted off to charity work because the bastions of industry were not fully open, at the same time, I think that women are sort of naturally drawn to the nurture.
Well, you know, this is what I find fascinating about it, because, and again, this is Robert's view of this kind of muddle of history I've been trying to play with. But it's interesting because, you know, when those women went to get grants, they went to the foundation world, which at the time was pretty much white men giving away money made by other white men.
Exactly.
And so, in effect, you know, they were told, as long as that's all you do, as long as you nurture, you'll be fine with us. Because as long as you're nurturing, you're not going to really be a threat. You're not going to challenge the status quo that made this money. So as long as you give poor people leftover food from restaurants or plant flowers or teach or arts, you know, that's fine. Fine, we'll give you little grants. I'm very interested in, and I've come to understand this probably has a lot to do with the culture of the nonprofit sector. But what's interesting is that learned behavior, that power dynamic that I'm fascinated, because just as much as we lament the fact that we're all too often given small grants and never really the kind of economic opportunity to achieve freedom, let alone independence, we did the same thing to poor people in many respects. And again, I go to human service groups. But this idea of we almost mimic the behavior we encountered by the foundation world and say, in effect, similarly, you know, come and get a little bit of food and we won't give you enough to be independent of us. We'll give you enough where you become literally you need us and we'll make you come back consistently. So what I'm trying to say is the sector itself needs to be liberated from first this kind of ashes and sackcloth notion. We've dressed it up because, you know, as we all know, redemption can't be achieved unless you've given more than you've received. So we've dressed all this up in this kind of ashes and sackcloth theatrics when, if it's done well, everybody rises up. But at the same time, I want to hold on tight to the ethics and the kind of moral core of what the sector has always been about. But at the same time, I always came up thinking, quite frankly, when I was a kid, that the nonprofit sector, as well as, you know, rock and roll music, were supposed to be challenging, liberating energy things. And one got hijacked, sold back as entertainment, and another as good deeds. And I just want to take them back and I don't want to go back to the 60s, but I think the voice of the nonprofit sector could be a powerful voice for equality, change, openness, tolerance, but also economically. It could be, the gateway to a really very, very exciting new economic form that puts people and planet and profit on equal stations.
And Robert, to build on that, one of the areas in which I think the nonprofit sector needs to have a very powerful voice, and this is a conversation that several GEO members have been bringing up to me and others. I was just talking to Tim Rourke from the New Hampshire Charitable Trust, and, you know, he's talking about the absolute bleak state of the budget in his state and the massive cuts to social services that are putting at risk the safety net and the service system that, in part, the New Hampshire Charitable Trust helped to build. And so the conversation that they're trying to lead is about the role of government in the care of its people. And that's a fundamental one that philanthropy, I think, needs to take on. There's a completely mistaken belief by some in government that private sources will be able to fill even any of the gaps that are going to be left in the current budget climate, and that's just not going to be the case. So a piece of the conversation that nonprofits and philanthropists need to come together around is to just clarify and demand the role that government needs to play in supporting its people.
Well, I'll tell you, the woeful lack of funding for advocacy from the foundation community is probably one of the top five reasons the sector is where it's at. The only way we're going to get where we need to be is to fundamentally go out and elect a generation of people who understand the dynamic, historic, imperative work of nonprofits, but also have a clear vision that says, in effect, look, we have raised an entire generation. 90 million young people have been raised doing service. The most diverse generation in the history of this country. And now what? In the baby boomers, what will in effect be the deepest well of life experience in the history of the world? How will I channel that energy? We have to elect people who fundamentally have a vision that includes that. And I don't think we can cross our fingers on the sidelines and hope that people like that get elected. We have to go out and elect them. We have to run for office ourselves. We need to have what in effect is an Emily's List for nonprofits that helps elect candidates who have as part of their vision some sense of, here's what I'll do if I'm elected, here's how I'll partner with the nonprofit sector, but more importantly, how I'll strengthen them to be a good partner to achieve my vision for this city, this state, or this country. So that's a big, important leap.
Robert, anticipating concerns of some of, for instance, my board members, how do you see nonprofits navigating the shoal waters of the prescription against electioneering and political process?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most amazing tools is the hashtag on Twitter. It allows you, me, Hildy, everybody to have our own personal Twitter accounts as citizens, but then communicate with each other that would say hashtag Arizona votes or hashtag California nonprofits vote. But it'll allow us to trade information and say openly, here's who I'm going to vote for and why. You know, so we can affect, be articulate and speak about who we fundamentally think should be elected to, quote, in effect, electioneer without crossing the line of saying, but I'm doing this on behalf of my nonprofit organization. But that's just one tool. I mean, the reality is we are so far from the line of demarcation for what nonprofits can or can't do. But my opinion is we should not, no election should go by without a candidates forum held by the broad cross-section of nonprofits.
That one got a lot of reaction. I guess it did. One of the things that's been very interesting in the work that we've been doing in building Creating the Future has really been observational, because what we're really looking at is the fact that we have never, as a sector, birthed ourselves. We have come into being by sort of all of the other factors that happened, and we just sort of are. No one ever set out with intent and said, if we were going to create mechanisms and means for accomplishing what we have the potential to accomplish, what would that look like? What we've done is we've adapted and we've adopted and we've looked at what we're allowed to do by our tax status, and we look at what the rules are, and we come up with a list of reasons why we can't do whatever it is that we know in our hearts we need to do. One of the conversations that I've been fortunate to have on this program in the past year is with Tom Kelly at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And Tom made it very clear when I asked him, what is the factor? What are the factors that really aim organizations at creating the change we have the potential to create? Tom was very clear. Tom is an evaluator. Tom has been an evaluator, a measurement guy for 20 years. And it was interesting to me that the one thing Tom found was that it is where we aim. It is what we hold ourselves accountable for creating in community rather than all of these little reasons of why we can and can't do things. And the thing that I find really fascinating in the work that all three of you are doing is in your own areas, each of you are really looking first at what is the change I'm aiming at creating, and then backing out, okay, what does that mean I need to do to get there? And what each of you have found, in my observation, is that it's all of the stuff that almost goes counter to, we have to compete to survive. No, we need to. I loved your expression, Margaret, nurture and connect. Kathleen, I know that when you and I were talking earlier in the year, or actually late last year, that we talked a lot about building those connections, but all towards what we're aiming at. What are you seeing out there in terms of building connections that are aimed all aligned in one direction?
Oh, you know, that is a big question. One thing that we've been doing a lot of thinking about, and there are some emerging examples to look to is about how to play a role in collaborative problem solving, and how do, you know, the very specific goals and objectives of each institution and particularly each funder either support or get in the way of some of this potential collaborative work. Now, Margaret articulated some of the typically female characteristics as it regards fight or flight. And when we're thinking about creating a collaborative approach to change, the type of leadership that's really needed is facilitative leadership. And it is leadership that is not waiting for the Superman hero leader. Yes, we need visionaries and we need people who can articulate a compelling vision, but we also need people who are willing to take the second or third chair at times and who are willing to put others out front when that is the appropriate thing to do to achieve what we're hoping to achieve. But this is all incredibly difficult work, and it's work that has to happen at the intersection of a lot of things. The intersection of philanthropy and nonprofits, oftentimes at the intersection of, you know, local government, private industry, and philanthropy and nonprofits. So the view that we need to take is a long one. Where we aim can't be at the target, 50 feet in front of us. It has to be at a target that's a bit further away and potentially a lot harder to reach. We actually have a speaker coming to our conference in a little bit that's going to talk about collective intelligence and how that plays in, and I think that that's something that we aren't yet very skilled at as a community is building collective intelligence in systems that are really hard to fully understand. Foundations are completely guilty of first wanting to try to map and understand the entire system before we intervene, and sometimes that's a fool's errand. The system is not fully mappable and understandable because of its complexity, but that doesn't mean that we can't intelligently engage. So that's a skill that I think we're all going to need to get better at in the years ahead.
You know, speaking of the years ahead, you know, one of the things that's also, I think, predictable but interesting nonetheless is that the conversation we're having now all speaks about, you know, transition. Almost based on what I assume is pretty much of a shared semi-generational construct. I mean, it sounds like we're all basically from the same, you know, kind of 60s, 70s, 80s era. But I tell you, one thing that I've become mesmerized by is I go back to this 90 million, which is a new number. I mean, up until about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I was saying there's like 70 million people under 25 in America. But new census data, which is coming out, looks like it's really closer to 90 million. And just like the boomers ahead, I guarantee you this younger generation is coming up who've been raised. We've raised them to think of their time as philanthropy. They're not going to have the extra money to write checks at the end of the year the way we did and the way, frankly, our sector is economically built upon. So you can predict there is going to be a completely unpredictable reaction here very, very soon. This generation's coming, and they're just not going to genuflect to our order. I spent a lot of time watching and listening to younger people who we've dismissed. Frankly, I can't believe the boomers of all people to turn around and dismiss this generation as apathetic or plugged in or I generation. They want it so fast. It's all about them. And it's like, dudes, they're us. They're our kids. And God bless them. We've raised them to think about their life in the community differently. I mean, go to any group of young people and ask them, how many of you all have been volunteering for more than 5 years, and watch the it's joyful in one level, but I think as a country we haven't really even begun to even think about what does that mean to have an entire generation coming up thinking about things like, can the way I spend my money be my philanthropy?
Mm-hmm.
Can the way I make my money be my philanthropy? And those, I think, are much braver, bigger why questions than a lot of the stuff we're doing now about evaluation and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
My youngest son is a junior at UC Santa Cruz, Econ Environmental Studies, double combined major. And his hero is Muhammad Yunus. And he looks at what I do and he goes, oh, Ma, that's so old school. It's got to be a social business. You have to create a structure where you don't have to ask permission for money, where the reins are in your hands, where you're in control, mm-hmm. and you can drive your own resources in that way. And he's right. He's thinking very differently. At least we can have the satisfaction, Robert, that someone in our generation, Mr. Yunus, was able to light a torch. But we do have to think in terms of integrating. And I think increasingly businesses, particularly after the economic downturn, you're seeing businesses think about social marketing as a way to find their viability. I'm even finding other nonprofits look to create deeper relationships amongst nonprofits within the community to improve their own sustainability.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I can riff on Yunus for a second, two things are very important. When Yunus started the Grameen Bank, he said, in effect, I'm going to do everything the opposite of what banks do. You know, banks only loan to men, I'll loan to women. Banks only loan to people with collateral, I'll loan to people with none. So, you know, all the way down the line. I'll be honest with you, when I started the kitchen, my attitude was, I'm going to do everything the opposite of the people I encountered who told me it couldn't be done. They didn't make money, I'm going to make money. They didn't market, I'm going to market. They weren't political, I'm going to be political. And I think that we could use a dose of that, what I call the, you know, the George Costanza principle of just doing everything the opposite, just once, and see, I think we'd be surprised how far we could get. But mm-hmm. the one thing about Yunus, just to bring this up, to talk about radical transformation, if in 1986 you had given Bill Gates $1,000 when Microsoft went public, you'd have $500,000 in the bank. But if you gave Muhammad Yunus in 1986 when the Grameen Bank started to open up, you would have only been eligible for a one-time tax deduction because you gave to a charity. Now, Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for elevating the better part of 100 million people, primarily women, out of poverty. Yet, that's the best we could do. Now, why not an annual tax deduction with increasing value based on the same rate of return principle as a dividend check if a nonprofit can show verifiable return on your investment? Now, imagine what that would do for a younger generation if they could actually attain wealth by investing in their community. Imagine what that would do for the nonprofit sector if you could still get a one-time tax deduction if you wanted to give to a reliable, traditional nonprofit. But for those like your son, and I think for programs like The Kitchen, who want to take a very different road, to be able to be liberated from the grant cycle, and frankly to have donors to be able to invest in their community and see wealth, I think that's an economic breakthrough that would do wonders in this for an economic turnaround in America. Yet it's not even on the table. No one's even discussing. In fact, if they're discussing anything, it's how to cut the contributions for the nonprofit sector.
We have got, I just want to give you guys the heads up, we've got about 5 minutes left, if you can believe that. In our remaining 5 minutes together or so, I'm thinking, Robert, about what you just said, and I'm thinking about the incredible, I know it sounds cliche to find opportunity in disaster, but this economic downturn happening at a time of such transition that all of us can just sense that there is something bigger than us that is shifting. I think we have the opportunity to really consider, I think a lot of stuff is on the table that never was on the table before. People are being incredibly creative and it's being encouraged, because it's very clear that the old ways, A, we can't go back to, and B, quite honestly, during the times that were supposedly the good economy, none of us were doing really well in this sector anyway. So I'm seeing tremendous opportunity to rethink how we all do our work. And what I'm hoping you guys can share in the last remaining minutes that we've got together, one at a time, I'm going to ask each of you, if you've got any thoughts about what kinds of things do you wish we could see happening that could undergird the kinds of change that we all know are possible? Robert, I'll start with you because you've always got something interesting to come up with.
Well, just every year in America, there's hundreds of elections. And I think now more than ever, you've got people who aren't encumbered by the notion of, I must float some tax bonds to try and attract a big factory. What you're seeing is a lot of people realize that it'll be thousands of small businesses. And that nonprofits, and particularly a younger generation of nonprofit leaders, are coming along with this vibrant sense of, maybe I can not only empower my organization, but maybe the people we serve and maybe even the larger community at the exact same time. But again, it's going to take electing a generation of people who aren't burdened by that notion of .orgs do this and .coms do that, that see, in effect, the whole community. And once you get that combined with this kind of all hands on deck, no idea is too crazy environment, I think to your point, Hildy, it's a great time to be an American.
Thank you. Kathleen, any thoughts about what big, hairy, audacious things you would like to see this sector start tackling?
I will narrow in and just think about what needs to be different in the money sources. You know, the folks who are primarily giving their money to others to do this work. And the most profound shift, in my view, would be if they sought out exposure to the people that they are ultimately intending to support in very meaningful and authentic ways. A real empathy experiment so that they are no longer making decisions without many of the facts and are more likely to have empathy for why folks ended up in a particular circumstance. You know, to go back to your diaper example, that reasonable people who have led good lives and tried their very best still end up in incredibly tough circumstances because of structural problems with the way that things are in our world. Structural barriers exist for some of these people. And I think that the more that is visible to the people who are donors, particularly in light of the giving pledge that the Gateses and Warren Buffett have been promoting, if each new billion-dollar donor who comes on the scene is increasingly in touch and in tune with the people and communities that they intend to support, then they're going to be making 100 better decisions every single day on behalf of those people, and their dollars will be used to even more powerful effect.
Wonderful. Margaret, what you thinking about that's huge?
Well, I'm thinking about rethinking the way businesses do business and what constitutes a profit. And I think that one of the things that I would like to see is individual businesses picking something that they're going to be about beyond producing the next film, picking something that they're going to really make that difference about. I think that Patagonia is taking a leadership position in that regard, that it doesn't have to all be huge bonuses and fourth and fifth homes for owners or execs or greatest shareholders, but the idea of a bottom line that has to do with social responsibility is critical. And in that regard, I think that businesses can find alliances amongst faith-based groups and within the nonprofit sector that could raise their bottom lines financially as well as socially.
You know, one of the Pollyanna principles is that everything and everyone is interconnected and interdependent, whether we acknowledge it or not. And that's truly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I just want to thank each of you for being with me today. This has been a great conversation. I wish I could do this every day. It'd be a great way to get my day started. I'm looking so forward to what the next year of conversations holds. And thank you to each of you for being with me today.
We love you, Hildy.
All right, yes. Thank you very much for creating the space for this conversation.
Thank you, Hildy.
Listening to this wide-ranging conversation, I'm reminded of the reason we began this series in the first place. The knowledge that this sector has the potential to create the kind of world we all want to live in, and that creating that change requires a combination of knowing what works and believing it's possible. And so the purpose of this series has been to engage in an ongoing conversation about bringing that core purpose back to center stage in all the work that we do. And while some of that has to do with how we all do our work, the far more important thing we so rarely take time to talk about is why we do this work in the first place. And so that's the purpose from which this program sprang. With that initial purpose so fresh in my mind, two thoughts occurred to me as I spoke with Robert and Kathleen and Margaret. First is that we're off to a great start in amplifying precisely the kinds of meaningful conversations we initially envisioned. If you check out the Chronicle's Making Change archive page, you'll find some of the great minds in social change sharing different aspects of what's happening when dramatic community improvement is taking place. Second, though, I'm realizing that year two of this program won't just be about the program itself, but about you, you who have dedicated your lives to making change. Whether you're working in a traditional nonprofit or a social enterprise, whether you're a foundation leader or a business leader, very few of us have the opportunity to have these kinds of rich discussions with colleagues. We may have these sorts of conversations with friends every once in a while, but most of us don't have the opportunity to have these sorts of deep, meaningful, exploring conversations with others with whom we could actually make a difference if we had the conversation. And so on this one-year anniversary of this program, I'd encourage you to use these podcasts to launch some of those conversations in places where you're already gathering. Perhaps once a quarter, open your board meeting with an episode that particularly relates to your work and have your board discuss how it all fits together. Perhaps begin your annual board retreat by listening as a springboard for launching into your planning work. Perhaps your networking group might dedicate every other month to listening and discussing, the modern-day equivalent of a book club. One thing is clear. There's far more we can accomplish together than any of us can accomplish on our own. And we can only do that if we give ourselves the opportunity to talk about the things that matter. To that end, please join in as we extend this conversation to the Chronicle of Philanthropy's Making Change group at LinkedIn. And remember that you can always find great ways to connect, plus terrific information overall at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter @philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this first year of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this program, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me on Twitter, I'm @HildeGottlieb, or at our website, creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.